pleasure to hand over our second speaker tonight, who is Roger.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm Roger, I'm that, eh? Yeah, nice to be here. I questioned myself, why have I done this before, but the answer is simply because I was asked. And if I can do a chair, I will do a chair, because it's about giving back. And if the people that did chairs when I presented to NA had not done them, where would I be today? I know where I'd be today. I'd be 6 foot underground. There's very little doubt in my mind about that. I don't go to a lot of meetings. I go at the moment, I go to one regular meeting a week. I'm pleased to say there are about five or six people that go to that meeting by here that are here by coincidence tonight, so it's nice to see them. And it's nice to see all the other faces, people I don't know. Yeah, I came to NA, before it was mentioned experience, strength and hope, and I have got a lot of all those things. Whether I can articulate them might be another matter. But I've got a lot of experience, I've got a lot of strength, and I've got a lot of hope. And my story's roughly like this. I'll start with the NA bit and just see what happens. I was frog marched into NA in 1985 by my heroin dealer because I was in a mess, right? And she and I was in a mess, of course, otherwise she wouldn't have got me there. Unfortunately, she died later. And I was in a mess. I didn't know I was an addict, and I didn't know I wanted to give up drugs. All I knew was that I couldn't carry on living like I was. I was on the road to nowhere. And what had been fun, what had been hip, what had been great for many years was now lonely above all, lonely and looking like it was terminal. And I was scared. I was really, really scared by this stage. I was 31, 32. I wasn't a spring chicken anymore. I started using late in contemporary terms. People started really early. I started using when I went to university. And I was really like a schoolboy. I should have been wearing short trousers when I went to university. I had no worldly wisdom. I came out of a loving middle-class family. They loved me. They wanted the best for me. I had a twin brother and a sister. And I turned up at university not having taken any drugs before. Now, it might be worth me backtracking a bit to just to explain what I can about my mental makeup. As I see it now, it's not as I saw it then, right? But there was no addiction in my family. My mum in later years suffered terribly from various very, very painful conditions and was on morphine. And she liked to drink and she was a nightmare. But this was a lady going into her 80s, so she can be forgiven for that, right? But at that stage, there was no addiction in my family. It was loving, it was protective, maybe overprotective might be a cause for argument. And it was a hard-working, middle-class Jewish family. Hitler will get a second mention in the meeting. because it is relevant. I was born in 1952, and it was austere British, like after the war times. My dad did well, he worked hard, small businessman. And he met my mum in the Royal Navy. They both were in the Navy during the war. My dad ended up as a junior officer. But as I grew up, I think I'm different from my twin brother. He's a bit like, he was like the tough guy, right? And he was not very sensitive either. you know, bless him, he's, you know, kind of, he's not very sensitive. He's a bull. He's testosterone led, and, you know, like everything, he approaches life head on, and I sort of skirt round the sides and check the angles and this, that and the other. But as I say, anyway, while I was growing up in the through the 50s and into the 60s, I didn't like what I saw about the world. I did not like it. The revelations were coming out slowly about the Holocaust, right? My dad never spoke about it, right? But I, you know, I was a sensitive child. I could see what was happening. It's like now a kid that's drifting in and out of his room now hearing what's going on in Syria. You know, they hear, they might not concentrate on it, but there were things filtering down to me that I didn't like, and I was very, very aware that it was possibly my butt that had been on the line. Right? At the same time that was going on, it was a Cold War between Russia and China, between Russia and America, and it was like the Bay of Pigs, and there was a strong feeling that the world could go up at any stage. I don't know how many people will remember that, but there was a very, very strong feeling that there could be nuclear Armageddon at any time. We were told at school, if the bomb goes up, don't look upwards, your eyes will be turned to jelly, you know, like hide under the desk. You know, I mean, this is a kid growing up, you know, it should be full of kids' concerns, and I've got all these kind of grown-up concerns that I don't understand as a grown-up, but I'm aware of. And I didn't like it. The civil rights movement was beginning. Black men were still being lynched in America. I just didn't like what I saw. And, you know, so I was protected from most of it and all that. I went to university and, there was a new generation of people. Right, it was Jimi Hendrix posters, it was Eric Clapton, I'll never forget Eric Clapton. Right, and on and on and on and on. And I could, but there was a whole youth culture thing, which, if I say I went for it lock, stock and barrel, only an addict possibly could go that into it that quickly and that hard and work that hard at getting good at it. All ideas of getting a degree went out in the first 2 weeks. I squatted at the university for 3 years taking drugs, fighting off sort of eviction orders and things like that. And you know, it was just a natural thing to do, and you know, I see it now. I had very little respect for elder people. I didn't like the world that I'd seen around me when I was growing up, and I honestly believed that me and my peer groups were going to change the world, and it was going to be different. And to that end. And also to pay my own bills, of course I started dealing, right? But I felt righteous about dealing. I honestly felt righteous. I thought that I was helping to change people's psyches and change their attitudes. And, you know, like drugs now, people know about drugs now. You know, maybe some people knew about drugs then, but at that stage it just seemed pretty harmless and not innocuous, it had the ability to change, and I wanted to be part of it. And I have to say, I don't go into a big one, but I enjoyed it and I had some very, very good times. As I've indicated, it didn't end up like that. Everyone moved on. All my contemporaries at university got degrees and went into their jobs. My twin brother followed in his father's footsteps, got a job, opened a business. Was successful, had two kids, and lived a normal lifestyle. There was I, 31, at home, on my mum's couch, right, because I never paid rent. You know, if you pay rent, that's money you could spend on drugs. So you either live at home, you squat, you bust into private properties and you squat, you do anything you want, but why pay rent, you know, when you've got that money for drugs? So, you know, I was in a very bad position when I came in. I was 31. All sorts of terrible things had happened. I'll give you a sort of indications of a couple of them. I Drugs of choice, I don't want to go into that one really, but at the end of my using, I got very, very, very badly fucked up on cocaine. And I went through a freebasing period, which was new then. And this is the sort of thing that happened, and this is the sort of person that I was when I took drugs. I was living in a top floor flat in West Hampstead, and I got a call from my late mother saying, your father's had a heart attack, he's in the Royal Free Hospital, get down there. Now, I have to tell you, I love my dad, right? I had no problem with him. He was, I had the pipe going, no one else there. I didn't have people around at this stage in my life, right? And I couldn't leave my drugs and paraphernalia until I had finished. Right? I had to wash up some more, clean the pipe, do this, do that, another smoke, da-da-da-da. I don't know, hour and a half, 2 hours later, after all the actions happened, nothing left, oh, I better get myself down the hospital. My dad was dead. You know, it was cold on a slab by the time I got there. You know, it adds a different kind of meaning to I got stoned and I missed it, you know. I was just powerless. I could not help myself. It was not from want of trying. It wasn't because I was a bad guy. That's just the sort of thing that drugs did to me. And that's the sort of guy I was. I mean, my mum and the show stall guy I was. When I did get there, my dad, I shouted out all the family that were there saying, why didn't you let me know first? As if they'd let me know first, I would have got there first, you know. just bullshit. Similar things happened for my mum, who my long-suffering mum, who put up with me for so many years. She used to, and her cleaning lady, because she had a cleaning lady, they used to find me occasionally, not often, but occasionally, overdosed with my set of works with me. And I had to witness lovely spectacles like this. I was, I'd overdosed on, in a bathroom, one of the two bathrooms of my mum's flat, and I was found, and the lady that found me, my mum wasn't in, phoned my brother. He rushed out from his business and came to see, pick up the pieces, see if I was still alive, this, that and the other. Obviously phoned the ambulance. When I came round being shaken, this, that and the other, he said, the ambulance is on its way, da 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 da. And I was so, this shows you the sort of states I used to get in, I got up unsteadily and just ran through French windows, you know, kind of pure glass with I don't know, partitions in between. I just didn't want to get caught. I didn't want to have to go to hospital. I didn't want to get them to stop whatever I did. So I just sort of ran through these windows. I kind of cut my arms open, this, that and the other. I was a complete fucking mess. Excuse me for swearing. That's what I'm trying to indicate to you. I was a complete mess. And then I got introduced to NA. So enough with the drugs. I'll try and tell you what happened when I got to NA. When I got to NA, the first thing that got to me was, here are people that are speaking my language. They've obviously done what sorts of things I've done. I can. They are speaking different words to me. I don't really know what they're talking about, but I know they've been in similar places and done similar things to me, and they're not the same as I am. They're happy. And these were people that were about 2 or 3 years clean, I think, because I don't think there were people more than 2 or 3 years clean. It might have stretched to 5, I don't know, someone else can tell me. But there were people ahead of me that were living a different life that I knew had been in places that I'd been. And I wanted it. It was like I hadn't believed it possible before. Messages I got was, once a junkie, always a junkie. My dad used to say, you're big enough and ugly enough to look after yourself, right? What were the other ones? All these things led me to think, you've made your bed, lie in it, right? That's it. you deal with it, pal. You know, and that's how I thought about my life. I thought, that is it. I've made my bed, and that's how I've lived, and that's how I'm going to die. And then suddenly, I see there's an opportunity, possibly, to turn this round, and possibly to live. And I wanted it, and I didn't know what I wanted. I wanted a way to take grade A drugs safely. That's what I wanted. I hadn't taken other drugs for a long time, but I wanted to be able to somehow rationalise and control my drug usage. And I didn't like God, I didn't like anything, but slowly, in 85 I started accumulating clean time by coming to meetings. I was using when I first came. And I think it might be worth just telling you what happened, my last using, and a very important and very seminal event in my using. I don't care if I was stoned, it affected me really, really fantastically for the better. When I was 66 days clean, I thought, I could see that it was possible to get clean, you know, to get clean and not use on a daily basis. And that scared me, and I thought, you know, this might mean I'll never use again. And I thought, I can't have that, right? I've just got to check whether these people have taught me enough to operate in a way that I can now control all the things that I've been doing. I mean, it's laughable now. Right, so what I did, I mean, you'll hear how laughable it was. I went and got a gram of cocaine. I went to Bliss the chemist and got a set of works. I drove home in a state of high agitation and excitement. And I thought, I'm going to go in the bathroom, I'm going to have a little hit. Then I'm going to come out and I'm going to put it aside. And I'm not going to use any more till the next day. Right? You all know what happened. Right? An hour later, I came out looking like the creature from the Blue Lagoon, eyes like this, shaking, right? And I knew I had options. I had options. There was a can of special brewing inside. I could go and phone my heroin dealer to get something just to unwire me, or I could go to a meeting. And I made the option to go to the meeting. And not only that, I have to tell you that in the scheme of things, something very important happened to me, and anyone can laugh, they can think I'm weird, but I think on that occasion, I really got a handle on handing it over in step three. Because until that time, I was beginning to get a handle that I was powerless over drugs. But I still... what was intent on dictating my own life and thought that was the way it was going to work. And in the immediate aftermath of this use app, I realised that I was completely without say in how my life turned out. I was just, I couldn't, it was not for me to dictate, you know, God, was it God proposes, man, or whatever. And I went into the garden there, and I was very, very shaky, as you can imagine. And this is the bit that I put myself up for ridicule. Right? But there was a large tree there. And there was something about, I was so shaky and so unsteady, mentally, physically, in every way, that I clung onto this tree. And I said to myself, and I said, whatever force there is in the universe... right, call it God if you want, but the force that gives that tree the ability just to be still and rooted in the ground and steady, I want some of that. And I just want some of that. I'm sick of being pushed to pillar and post by my own, you know, by my own using, and I want something else in my life. And you know, I it was only a long time later that I realised that was my step three. That I had actually asked for something outside of myself to help me, because I knew I couldn't help myself anymore. That was the last time I used. That was in 1986. So That gives me 28 years clean time. How could I begin to explain the differences over in the 28 years since then? What I found, I've not been most probably the model recovering addict. I've always found sponsorship difficult. I do have two or three people that phone me up on a sort of fairly regular basis and we chat about things. Some of them call me their sponsor, but I find having a sponsor difficult, I have to admit. I've never been in a hurry to do the steps. And I found, and I don't suggest anyone does this out of choice, it's just the way my life has worked. I never went to treatment. And I never, maybe because I never had a sponsor, but I did have a sponsor for a time, and this was the kind of guy was, when it came to doing a step four, I was encouraging him to tell me to do a step four. I said, please, you know, I don't know about time, and he said, you'll do it when you're ready, right? You'll do it when you're ready. If you're not ready, you won't do it, right? And you'll do your step four when you are ready. And he refused to tell me to do a step four. And I did do a step four, lo and behold, when it was right. And I've done every step as and when I've needed to. And there have been times when I haven't needed to do a step, and I've been involved in that, what do you call it, a bridge to normal living. I've been doing normal living with many of the lessons that I've learnt in this room from, you know, all the people in this room. But there sometimes comes a situation in my recovery where I hit some sort of a wall and I don't immediately think of a step. Oh, I must go back to the steps. It doesn't work like that with me. But lo and behold, it is something to do with the recovery process and it's stalled. And, I'll tell you very quickly what happened at step six. Is it step six? I think it is. In step four and five, I found out that I was a real selfish piece of work. Really nasty. Not because I'm like that now, but drugs made me a real selfish bastard. I didn't care about anyone. I just wanted what I wanted. And everyone else can go fuck themselves, right? And I found that out, and I, you know, because this was against what I thought. I thought I'd wang out a line for anyone. I hadn't wanged out a line for anyone for years, you know. But anyway, the point being, I got in a relationship with a girl in NA, and it didn't work. Right? No, I was a few years clean. It was a few years clean. It was kind of, it could have worked. Potentially, it could have worked. Right? It didn't work, and there was a lot of sexual obsession. There was a lot of, and I was running around in mental anguish and pain that I hadn't felt for years. I was leaving notes under a windscreen wiper. I was like a headless chicken. I was all over the place. And somehow or other it dawned on me, not that it was because it was back to step four and five. I wanted what I wanted, in this case, that particular woman. She was recovering as well. She has a right to decide who's right for her. Whether she wants a man in this stage in her life, she was trying to run her own recovery, you know, or run her own life. And somehow it dawned on me that all this anguish I was giving myself was because of, you know, all the shortcomings that were me, you know, selfish. You know, I want her because I want her. She's got nothing to, you know, she just has to say yes, right? You know, and so, but it reached me to a stage where I said, please remove this whole obsession with getting what I want all the time. You know, and so what I'm trying to say to you is things in life happen and I get irresistibly drawn back to the steps. You know, because they are a mechanism for change. They're a mechanism for change. And I think most people, certainly me, when I came to NA, I wanted to be me without the drugs. And that was a contradiction in terms. There was no me without drugs. There was me with the drugs. When you took the drugs away, there was a very, very shaky individual that had to grow in some direction because he couldn't do what he had been doing. So, you know, I'm just saying that I'm very, very conscious that the steps are there. They're a mechanism for change, and I have used them when I've needed to. I spoke to my daughter on the way here, and yeah, I haven't even told you I got a daughter. I had no, I got married in recovery. That's a great story. I should tell you that. So the way I met my wife, right, was I was at a party in the West End. I was working, believe it or not, as a financial analyst. I didn't know anything about money, about how much drugs it was. But somebody gave me a job. I took my earring out, put a suit on, and I went into an office as a financial analyst. And I was about 6 years clean, and I wasn't happy about myself. I didn't like the fact that I wasn't using, you know, going to a party and not, you know. So I was there, and I was quite, you know, picking at a salad and drinking water, cheers, you know. And a guy came up to me, I didn't know, and he started chatting to me, and he said, if there's one girl in this party, they were singing, it was a live party sort of thing, that you fancy, who would it be? And I was like, no, I don't fancy any of these ones, you know, this, that and the other. They said, come on, if there was one. So I said, okay, that one, you know, that's just finished singing over there. And he said, you wouldn't believe it. He said, that's my next door neighbour. She's a lovely girl. I'll go and introduce you to her. I'll bring her. And I'm going, no. Right? And he was off, right? Now, what this bloke did, he went up to her. He didn't know her. He went up to her and he said, my friend over there that I've known all my life, right, is very shy, but he's a lovely guy. I can speak for him. He's a lovely guy, but he's very shy, and I know he fancies. Would you come and join him for a drink? And my wife, being my wife, said, sure, no problem. And he came and brought her over, put her in front of me, and disappeared. And we were both thought that it was the other one's friend, and we never saw him again, right? And we never saw him again. Now, you know, I don't know that. I strange things have happened to me in my recovery. That most probably is the best because, you know, affairs of the heart are very, very. They can be make or break, aren't they? If whether you're having a good life or not, you know, they're the things. They are for me anyway. And, you know, that's how I met my wife. After four proposals by her, we eventually got married many years later, and we now have a nice, glorious little 13-year-old child who I'm intent on giving every single advantage that I had and I squandered, right? And, you know, all I can say is, I know, I'm not a fool, I know, I could destroy it in a second. You know, what's that saying they say? Anything you put in front of your recovery, you will lose. And I just know that. If I decided that my family were more important than my recovery, I would stop going to meetings, I would go to Auntie Edith's party, it's expected that you have a glass of sherry, you know, whatever it is. If I just started putting other things in front of my recovery, I would lose the lot. I have no doubt whatsoever that using anything would take me back to using everything. I don't know how quickly, but it wouldn't be long. That's for sure. Yeah. So, you know, I'm a happy customer. I'm a happy customer with NA. And, you know, people, as I say, it's, I mentioned it. I started saying, mentioning it to my daughter. I phoned her out a minute ago and said, because her mother's out working. And I said, I'm out, darling, I'll be back 9. I'll do some cooking, this, that, and the other. And she said, where are you? I said, I'm with my friends. Right, because She knows nothing about NA. She knows nothing about my past. My wife knows the mildest details. She knows I go to a meeting once a week on a Saturday, and I try and say, I don't care if the kid's got a gymnastics competition, I'm at that meeting, right? And because I put my recovery first, and it's the way it has to be, and it's not a chore. I love it. When I go to meetings and I see people at various different stages in their recovery, I'm very glad there are people ahead of me as well. It fills me with hope. It fills me that hope that a life that that I thought was sort of over or as good as over, you can turn round. And, I'll leave it at that. Thanks very much. Thank you.